We're joined by David Graeber. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths University of London, and he's the author of the new book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. David Graeber, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I want to get your sense before we dive into 5,000 years of issues concerning debt about what's happening right now with the debt ceiling debate. Again, it's an artificial thing. It was created first by Congress in 1917. Obviously, it has been raised a number of times over the years. But what's your take on what's happening right now over this debt ceiling?
Well, I mean, it's a perfect illustration of one of the premises of my book, which is that when we talk about debt, it's mostly has nothing to do with economics. It's really, we're talking about morality. And it's almost a way of scoring political points whenever you appeal to debt, responsibility. It strikes a chord in people. But in this case, it's so flies so flagrantly in the face of even the most elementary economic common sense that it's really quite scandalous. In fact, the U.S. has always run a deficit. I think there was one time in U.S. history where any serious attempt was made to balance the budget, and that didn't turn out too well under Andrew Jackson. Everybody's perfectly well aware of it. So it's this kind of morality play in which all parties know perfectly well that the stakes are not what they claim them to be.
Well, let me ask you this, and you're also a as well as being an anthropology professor, also a self-described anarchist. I have flippantly said through this, in our coverage of this entire issue, if the debt limit is not raised and the turmoil that it can cause for the economy, well, this could be something that anarchists would, if you're somebody who wants to see this system, this capitalist system really in crisis, opportunity to tear it down, well, this could be it if it wasn't raised. But again, I flippantly said that, so perhaps I can get your perspective on that.
Well, I'm thinking long-term perspectives when I talk about anarchism. I mean, I think that we would be better off in the long run to have a genuinely free society, and I can't imagine how there could be a genuinely free society where you have systematic military-style structures of coercion, which we call states. In the short run, actually, the economic arguments that I'm making are really point as much and are as easily reconcilable, I would say, with liberal positions than with anarchist ones. I'm not saying we should push the system into crisis. I am saying that we need to think about the degree to which military power ultimately underpins economic relations. This is one of the themes of my book, because one of my great discoveries is that while we'd like to juxtapose the market and the state, and then say those are kind of the two possibilities, and that history is a struggle between the two, the thing that really emerged from my own study of the history of money is how much these things have always been intertwined. And cash markets, markets in which people use coinage or actual bullion or script, rather than credit systems, really emerge as a side effect of military operations. And to this day, our money system is closely pegged to war debt. That's always been the case, at least since the 18th century, 17th century. So I think that, you know, if there is an anarchist perspective in the book, it's just paying attention to the role of the state in creating markets, the way these things have been wed to one another. And I don't really lay out any policy prescriptions. I just want people to be aware of the way things really work.
Yeah, and again, in looking at this debt ceiling issue, behind it is the issue of the national debt. Who owns our debt? Who is our creditor?
Well, a very large amount, this is the terrible secret, is owed to ourselves. That's one reason.
Owed to ourselves?
Yeah. The vast majority, we have this sort of idea that we're in hock to China, but they hold a very, very small percentage of the debt, and they don't really expect to get that back. This is why the whole system is, the whole argument that people are making is so illusory. A very large percent of that debt is actually owed to the Federal Reserve, because the way the Federal Reserve works is Federal Reserve has the power to print money, but it doesn't just give that money to the government. The government can't print money. It lends it to the government. Well, the Federal Reserve could easily sort of finagle that in all sorts of different ways if they really wanted to, because the way money is created is a political decision and could be done differently. Other parts of it, of course, are owed to citizens, investors, and to foreign central banks, foreign investors, and foreign governments. I think maybe at this point it's gone up to a quarter, or maybe even 30% is owned overseas. But it's not like an ordinary debt because, first of all, it can't really be called in very easily. There was a time before 1971 when, in theory, you could call that in gold. Dollars were redeemable in gold. Then somebody actually tried it in 1971. George Pompidou actually sent a battleship to New York Harbor and said, "Give me my gold." And Nixon just said, "All right, fine, we go off the gold standard." I mean, nobody can really call in that debt unless America wants them to. In terms of the Treasury bonds, and the Treasury bonds are essentially rolled over. Michael Hudson has been pointing this out for years. That's what the debt consists of, U.S. Treasury bonds. Since Nixon went off the gold standard, those Treasury bonds have essentially come to substitute for gold. I mean, they're literally as good as gold, as the reserve currency that central banks use. So when they have holdings, they keep it in Treasury bonds. That's considered the safest possible investment. As a result, they never cash them in. They roll them over every 5 or 10 years. And in fact, economists have argued it's an indirect tax. One could even think of it as tribute, perhaps, paid to the U.S. since they pay less than inflation. Now, so basically what that means is the U.S. has the ability to write checks that no one ever cashes. So talking about that as if it were a debt and as if it were a crisis is a little illusory. The only danger is that if the U.S. loses that AAA good as gold standard, people might try to create a different type of international reserve system. And there have been murmurings about that. Russia has been on about it occasionally. China sort of says maybe we'd be interested in this.
Strauss-Kahn.
Yeah, Strauss-Kahn, like, before the whole little thing that happened to him, was talking about it as well, and everybody's like, gee, they're kind of amazed that America's going along with that. But it would require a massive rewiring of the way the world works. So the irony of the current debt crisis is the only thing that could possibly endanger the U.S.'s position is precisely what the Republicans are doing.
And that's not raising the debt ceiling, which would cause
a default.
A default
and the lowering of the U.S. credit rating, which is, you know, as AAA as you can possibly get at the moment.
I mean, the Treasury bond interest rate right now is, what, 2.9%, which is quite low. And when there's that uncertainty, that's what normally will drive that interest rate up.
Which will, of course, drive up the debt. I mean, the whole thing is insane.
Yeah.
They're trying to create a crisis that would never have otherwise existed, maybe, you know, 10, 20 years down the road if we'd been completely irresponsible. We have to wonder, what exactly are they thinking? Are they trying to undermine the entire structure of U.S. power in the world? Why would they want to do that?
That's something I've been wondering, both parties, really. I mean, you know, we think of this duopoly, both beholden to Wall Street, and seems like they're, you know, like they're facing each other down, willing to give up their power structure.
It's quite remarkable. I mean, it's possible there are things going on behind the scenes we don't know about.
Yeah.
It might have to do with reshuffling of American military power, which has, and this is the great mystery, and, you know, it's clear that in world history, or recent world history, whatever country is the great superpower, their currency tends to be the international currency. That's true of the dollar. How that works, what is the relationship between U.S. military spending, the fact that U.S. has military bases all over the world, the hegemony of the dollar, and the way the financial system works, and of course things like the trade imbalance, the fact that we send much less to the rest of the world than they send to us, and this seems to just go on year after year, regardless of what you think would be economic common sense. Those are all related somehow. I mean, some of the connections are not hard to see. Historically, the people who have bought the most Treasury bonds have tended to be countries under U.S. military protection, Japan, South Korea, the Gulf states. So there's a systematic connection that way. A lot of the deficit is basically war debt. If it wasn't for U.S. military spending, we probably wouldn't even have a deficit if you count military spending, not just by the way they cook the books, but by in its entirety. That debt, therefore, is funded by treasury bonds, which are bought by the very countries or the U.S. Army, which those treasury bonds are essentially paying for or sitting on. Now, you could call that protection money in either sense of the term. You know, either they're hiring us to protect them or we're shaking them down. I mean, it's kind of a little halfway between both. The interesting question is why China wants to get in on this game. Obviously, they're a military rival and not a military protectorate. But if you look at Chinese history, and this is one of the things I wanted to do in the book, is contextualize this in very deep history, you find that China has a lot of experience playing remarkably similar games of essentially bribing potential, what they consider to be scary, violent barbarians. Started with the Central Asian steppe nomads who are always threatening to overwhelm their northern borders, but they did it to Korea, Japan. Setting up incredibly favorable trade deals as part of what they called the tribute trade system as a way of sort of softening them and making them dependent, less of a military threat. So it's possible that in the long term, their dream is to sort of let us down slowly from our imperial plateau as they see it and, you know, keep the U.S. Army as a protector of their own interests. It's possible. I don't really know what they're thinking. It's also possible that there's some sort of tacit deal going on because they pretend to get upset about the debt, even though I strongly suspect they couldn't care less. I mean, these guys are trained as Marxists. They're interested in material infrastructure, you know, and they're getting lots of that. They're getting the highways and airports and roads and super fast trains, and the U.S. isn't. So the fact that the U.S. isn't paying their debt is probably of little concern to them. But, you know, they, for purposes of appearance, they get mad about the debt every now and then. And for purposes of appearance, the U.S. gets mad about intellectual property rights and technology transfers, even though in fact they don't care. So I think there's some sort of tacit deal going on that way.
Again, we are speaking to David Graeber. He teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and he's the author of the new book, Debt, The First 5,000 Years. David Graeber, in your book, you write that history of debt is a history of morality, a struggle between rich and poor, creditors and debtors.
Yes. And what I found when I was researching it is just how ambivalent a weapon it really is. Almost invariably, if someone conquers someone else, if there is a situation of extreme inequality and enforced ultimately by violence, the people on top will try to convince the people on the bottom that they owe them something, if only for not killing them, for example. Conquering armies. I mean, this is a trick done with colonialism all the time. They would come in and basically say, you now owe us for the cost that it took for us to outfit the army it took to conquer you. Whatever the excuse is, telling people that they are in your debt is the easiest way to take a situation of violent inequality and make it seem like the victims are to blame. The problem is that it implies a certain equality. And the great paradox of this situation that I discovered is that the vast majority of revolts, insurrections, revolutions, conspiracies, uprisings, that you see in world history have been about debt. Much, much more than about slavery, about serfdom, about, you know, caste systems in India. Systems of just pure structural inequality that are just called that, have a hierarchy, you are inferior, tend to not make people nearly so angry as the language of debt. Because when you're saying you owe me something, you're also saying you could be my equal.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we certainly see that in the fall of the Roman Republic as it went to a Roman Empire. Caesar.
Oh yeah,
was promising Caesar, you know, came into power promising to, let people out of their debt.
Pretty much every political crisis or popular political crisis in the ancient world was about debt. In Mesopotamia, it came so that kings would simply have to declare clean slates. Pretty much every Sumerian, even people like Hammurabi, when they came to power, the first thing they did is they said, okay, all debts forgiven, start over again. Because there was a danger of their society falling apart and of it becoming so polarized that you just have, it would be divided into a bunch of lords and their serfs and slaves, which wasn't really good for the king. Now, same thing was incorporated in biblical jubilees. In the ancient world, both Athenian democracy and the Roman Republic really emerge out of political struggles over debt. And in their case, they didn't so much forgive the debts as they threw money at the problem. They figured out ways to just pass lots of cash to the people who would otherwise become debtors and declared that debts were still had to be respected. There are different solutions. That worked in the imperial centers. It meant that people in places outside Athens and Rome ended up in debt slavery, and that's one of the reasons they had so many slaves in that society. A lot of the world religions that crop up in that same period, and this is true not only in places like Greece and Rome, but in India and China at the same time, where remarkably similar things were going on, were in a way reactions to that, and almost all of them problematized debt on one level or another, which is why in the Middle Ages you have in Islam and Christianity bans on usury. So it's always at the very center of political arguments.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about China and Asia, and I guess China and India, and I guess what's considered the Axial Age.
Yeah.
In India, you have the birth of Siddhartha Gautama, mm-hmm. And also the creation of the Upanishads. In China, you have Laozi, Tao Te Ching, and also Confucius.
Mm-hmm. All around the same time. And the fascinating thing is that it all happens right around the same time as they invent coinage. Coinage is invented, I guess, in the Aegean first. They move the dates around, they're not quite sure. But
the Kingdom of Lydia?
Kingdom of Lydia, around 600 BC, maybe a little bit earlier. You see the first coinage, but rapidly thereafter it appears in China and India, and it doesn't seem to be the idea spreads, because they're using totally different technologies to make currency. It's more like a similar social phenomena are happening, which is essentially the rise of empires and standing armies, which in turn leads to massive chattel slavery. And then you get these rise of world religions and philosophical schools that appear almost immediately thereafter in the same places. I mean, Greek philosophy is born in Miletus, which is also the same city as the first to use coinage. It's really interesting to look at how and why that happens. And a lot of the book contains some speculations about what must have been going on. But socially, it's very significant that most of these philosophical and religious movements start as peace movements. Coinage begins as a way of paying soldiers. It has to do with empires and war. Most of the movements that arise against it are all about not behaving that way, or at least creating a domain of peace, a place of peace apart from the ordinary life, which is assumed to be an increasingly violent and insecure place. I mean, to the degree that a lot of the early philosophical movements were social movements in ways that would be immediately recognizable today. One of my favorites is the Moists in China. They actually were a group of rational dialecticians who also created military technologies, and they decided they were going to abolish war by bringing those military technologies to the side of whoever got it, didn't start it. So they would intervene in wars on behalf of the victims, and they thought if they did this systematically, people wouldn't attack each other anymore.
Another fascinating thing I found in your book, again, we are speaking to David Graeber, author of the book Debt, the First 5,000 Years, is that such words as amnesty, restitution, redemption, guilt, sin have their root in this issue and over debt.
Yeah, it's a remarkable how consistent that is. And that's partly because those world religions, which start as a reaction to the sacred idea that debt is sacred, which comes with these military empires, you know, in earlier ages, debt was not considered sacred, had to use the language of debt, even as they also rejected its basic premises. This is what I meant by the great paradox you see here. People kind of feel they have to argue in those terms and then turn it around. It kind of makes a certain sense, because if somebody conquers you, for example, and says, okay, now you owe us, and is constantly berating you about how irresponsible you are about not making your payments, the only real moral reaction you can make is to say, wait a minute, now who owes what to who here? But as soon as you do that, you're using the language of debt and assuming that debt is morality, which, of course, is a very, very slippery path and leads to terrible contradictions. And you might say that the whole tradition of Western and probably Eastern philosophical and ethical thought begin with that problem. I mean, you can see it in Plato's Republic. It begins, what is justice? And some old rich guy says, well, justice is just paying your debts. Socrates deconstructs that one pretty quick. But if not that, what then? And that question, if not that, what then, is the question that in the Brahmanas, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, in Buddhist scriptures as well, I mean, everybody's trying to answer.
And looking at the issue of debt today, again, it's been made to be the biggest issue from the banking crisis now to government debt. And I know you don't see U.S. debt the same way you see the Greek debt. But if we look at the global debt issue right now, can you see this in a historical context?
Absolutely. Another one of the things that I didn't really expect, and I was quite startled when I began researching the book, is how regularly across Eurasia you see the same patterns of history. I've already been a little foreshadowing this in the discussion of Mesopotamia and Greece and Rome,
yeah.
But the biggest discovery was that, you know, while we like to think of virtual currency, which we've been moving to ever since the U.S. went off the gold standard in 71, creation of credit cards and computers and so forth, we like to see this as this kind of unprecedented, brave new world, and we don't know where it's taking us. Actually, virtual money is the original form of money. Money existed as a system of accounting, as a way of credit, a system of credits and debts and keeping account of them, long before people were using currency in everyday transactions. And history alternates between periods dominated by virtual money. The first couple thousand years of history is basically virtual money, with gold and silver only occasionally used in actual transactions, usually big ones, to a system where you of actual currency, which you get with the invention of coinage, where people are really going to the marketplace of tiny little pieces of bronze, gold, and silver and buying chickens with them and so forth, which tend to be periods, for example, the Axial Age itself, of standing armies, war, slavery, also philosophical materialism also. And then it goes back to virtual money again. So that once these social movements that then get enshrined in the world religions ultimately win out in one form or another, the armies are disbanded, the money, cash money disappears, people go back to virtual systems of money, so that in China they invent paper money, in the Middle East checks are already in common usage by 1000 AD in Basra. Most merchants are paying by check. Check is actually an Arab word, by the way. In Europe, they're using notch sticks, tally sticks, which actually the Bank of England only gave up on in 1825, if I'm not mistaken. So they have these very complex credit instruments that people are using. And to some degree, it's all based on honor and trust. In medieval English villages, people just kept track of who owed what to whom. Only about 10% of transactions actually involved currency. And, there'd be like every year or half year, they'd have what they'd called a reckoning. People would try to make a big circle. Well, you owe this to him, and you owe that to him, and you owe that. Oh, can we cancel that out? And all those things they couldn't cancel, somebody would give somebody a pig or some cash or whatever they had around. So virtual money systems are actually almost the norm for much of human history. It's only around 1500, actually starts around 1450, the real key change happens in China. There's a huge demand for silver, which then creates a market for the American gold and silver, which mostly ends up in Asia. It's a long story. But what happens is all that American bullion shows up. You go back to a system where people think that money should be a physical thing. It takes forever before they can actually produce enough coins that people actually can go to the shop and buy things. I think really only in the 19th century, even in England, did they have enough coins that most people didn't have to put things on the tab or use tokens issued by the shop or some other expedient. So it's only quite recently we've moved away from virtual currency, and then it lasts about a couple hundred years, and suddenly we go back to it again.
You think we could go back to it again?
We are going back to it. I mean, the problem is we're going back to it in a way.
I don't mean virtual currency. I mean, could we go back to actual hard physical currency again?
I think that historically, the you know, we're talking since 1971.
Yeah.
The cycles of history I'm looking at are 1,000 years, 500 years long. Maybe we'll go back to physical history, physical currency around 2,500. And we're only talking 40 years since 71. That's nothing historically. We're at the very beginning. But I think there's reason to hope, because when you have a period of virtual currency, it becomes impossible to imagine the economy as something completely separate from other social relations. And I think this is the really important thing. You know, if you say money is just gold and silver, it's a commodity we use to measure other commodities, it's possible to argue, as economists do, that the economy is this autonomous field with its own logic and you must respect it and markets run themselves. What we discovered in 2008 is, in a way, the first really hard, solid blow to that old, now outmoded assumption. We realize that markets don't run themselves and that debts can be made to disappear. They're social constructs. I think something like $13 trillion in debt was made to disappear. And that's typical, because, as I say, in periods of virtual money, it's obvious that money is a social thing. It's not a physical object. It's a promise. It's an IOU. It's a series of commitments that people make to one another. And it only stands to reason, therefore, that commitments can be renegotiated if you have to do that. There's nothing sacred about it. And that's why you get things like Mesopotamian clean slates, like biblical jubilees, like, you know, all that goes by the boards in Greece and Rome, where they have physical money and they're trying to pretend money is a thing. But in the Middle Ages, once again, everybody assumes that money is a social construct. Money is whatever the king says it is. And the king says cheese is money this week, then cheese is money. It's an agreement that people have with one another. And as a result, they could have laws against usury and all these different controls to make sure that the credit systems don't take on a life of their own and go crazy. Now, what happens and also to protect debtors from becoming permanently enslaved? What's been happening since 71? Well, precisely that. First, the credit systems get out of control and go crazy. And second of all, people are being reduced to slavery. I mean, most people in America do feel like debt slaves. And I always make the point, you know, if Aristotle were here today, he would not make much of a distinction between selling yourself as a slave, which is what debtors used to have to do, or renting yourself as a slave, which is what debtors do now. He would think they're basically the same phenomena and that most Americans are, in fact, slaves. Now, if history runs true, what we will see is some sort of political system designed to protect debtors and to keep the system from running out of control. Now, here's the anarchist thing again. Whether it is possible to maintain something which we could call capitalism under that system, I don't know. But it's going to happen, I would say.
Going back to what you were saying earlier, which I found interesting, is we think of virtual money that we're going into now, the use of our debit cards, credit cards, buying things on the computer, mass transactions occurring with a click of a mouse and all of these things. We think we're going in the future, but this is very interesting because this idea of virtual money is actually a very old idea, even before the invention of coinage.
Absolutely. For the first 2,000 years at least of the history of money, there was no coinage. People mainly used, you know, people would go to the bar and put things on the tab. Money was essentially a way of measuring things. It was a unit of account rather than a physical object.
Now, what about the morality of debt? One thing we continually hear, and we hear it in the political debates that are occurring right now, that, and I believe this, if I borrow David Graeber $20 from you, I believe I should pay you back.
Well, sure. And on the other hand, if you borrow money from me and you're broke this week, I will take that into consideration. And maybe if you're rich, I'll expect you to give me a little more. You know, I mean, people, when they're dealing directly with one another, it's not pure what we would call economic consideration, sort of cold-blooded calculation of profit and what you can get away with. That is the only factor. When you're dealing with rich and powerful people, that is still the case. Rich and powerful people can be remarkably generous, forgiving, and understanding when dealing with each other. This kind of absolute morality of debt only applies to the little people like you and me.
But it's a whole different game on the bigger picture, and we saw that with the subprime mortgages.
Precisely. The big players were bailed out, like their gambling debts were made to somehow disappear through various means that we weren't supposed to understand since they were very, very complicated. And real people, for the most part, had to give up their houses or, you know, figure out a way to pay the money.
And for the bankers in this, the way you described it was sort of, it was a game of hot potato. You know, we have this thing. You can make a lot of money on it right now on this, you know, this bundle of derivatives or whatever it was. You can make a lot of money on it right now. Whoever is left holding it when it's revealed that there's nothing there, they're the ones who will lose. But until then, it's a great gamble where you can make a lot of money.
Exactly. I mean, this goes back to almost all of the great bubbles have been built on that principle, or arose on that principle. The South Sea bubble, I quoted considerably in the book, where they said, you know, every fool wanted to be a knave. Basically, everyone figured that they were going to rip off somebody else. Everybody knew that this stuff was worthless, but the idea is, well, I could, you know, this guy thinks I'm a sucker to buy it, but I can find an even greater sucker who's going to buy it from me. So nobody really believed this stuff was real, but it didn't matter. And the bankers were doing something very similar to one another.
So again, getting back to this issue of, you say, a commonality of all, can we say all or almost all popular insurrections have been due to debt?
There are exceptions, I'm sure, but it's the vast majority. Moses Finley, the great classicist, once said that there was basically one revolutionary program in all of antiquity, and that was annul the debts and redistribute the land, in that order. You find it quite astonishingly regularly when there's a peasant insurrection, the first thing they do is they go find the money lenders' ledgers and burn them, or slates, or wipe them, or whatever the form they physically might take. Then they go after the land cadastres, and maybe after that the tax records, and if those are different. It always seems to happen that way.
What do you think this means for now?
Well, there is a beginning of a popular rebellion against this. I mean, we see it in Greece, we see it in Spain. It hasn't been much covered in the American media, but it's been covered a lot in the European media. And I think some of the things that we're seeing in the Middle East are more connected to this than we think as well. I read a very interesting essay about microcredit in Egypt. Had a lot to do with the Egyptian Revolution, because the Egyptian government went from sort of social welfare model to this idea that microcredit will save the world. Gamal Mubarak was really into this. He used to work for Bank of America. And the police were kind of the enforcers. They were the guys who came to break your legs if you couldn't pay. And a lot of this revulsion against police brutality had directly to do with debt collection. The Saudi reaction to that, this didn't get airplay at all, but it's quite fascinating. Yes, they beefed up security, they raised salaries, but they also did a biblical-style debt annulment. I think they had paid for it using petrodollars. They didn't just say all debts are off, but they actually paid everybody's debts. So it's a very, you know, that's where they see the unrest is potentially coming from. So I think that a lot of these movements in favor of real democracy are a recognition exactly of the lesson of 2008, which is, well, if we have money, which is a set of social arrangements, a set of promises we make to each other, well, what does democracy mean if it doesn't mean that the people as a whole get to decide what types of promises are made, which ones have to be respected, and to what degree?
During the 1990s, when we talked about debt, and in the early 2000s as well, it was always connected to the IMF, the Global South, Africa,
indeed,
debt relief. Can we see what's happening today now with Europe and the United States as a continuation?
It's a remarkable continuation. I mean, most people don't understand what really happened. And again, in my terms, the IMF, the creation of the IMF, was almost the exact opposite of what one would normally expect in a period of virtual money. A period of virtual money, usually you have some sort of large overarching institution, the church, sacred kings, who step in and act to protect debtors. Instead, they produce this global trade bureaucracy, of which the IMF is the pinnacle, which is designed to protect creditors. Nobody should ever default. which defies all economic reason, too, incidentally. Another reason why I say it's a moral and political thing. All right, so the IMF does the opposite of what you would expect. But again, you know, we're talking about 500-year cycles for 40 years in, and the IMF immediately faces massive popular resistance around the world. And as I say, most people don't realize that the IMF has effectively been kicked out of most of the world. After the East Asian crisis, basically no state in Asia will deal with the IMF at all. Gradually, Latin America got rid of their IMF debt, and they refused. One or two countries left in Latin America that are willing to talk to the IMF. So the IMF is now limited to increasingly narrow parts of the world. Europe is one of the few places where they do have free rein. Egypt kicked them out a few weeks ago, as a matter of fact. They announced that owing to popular feeling after the revolution, they couldn't make could no longer deal with the IMF. So the IMF is doing exactly the same sort of thing that they used to do to the Global South, and the Global South has, for the most part, all those parts of the Global South that are in any way in economic shape to do so, essentially successfully stop them from doing. Now they're doing it to Europe. It's the same thing. Declare a crisis, save the rich guys, say everybody else has to pay, prescribe neoliberal medicine. And they're meeting up with exactly the same sort of resistance, which is grassroots horizontal resistance in the name of real democracy.
What about, and we're almost out of time here, credit rating agencies and driving this? Is there a historical connection there to any other time?
That's a really interesting phenomena. In a way, you could say that this idea of financiers, capitalists, banding together in that way goes back to perhaps the 16th or 17th century, when Philip II tried to default on loans, as medieval kings regularly did, and suddenly all the bankers kind of, the ones in Germany, the ones in Italy, closed ranks against them and said, well, you know, if you're going to default to one of us, you're not going to get any loans from any of us. You can say that entire phenomena, that sort of self-organization of the capitalist class, or financial class in this case, which overwhelming amounts of capital now, financial speculative capital, much, much more than anything that's actually in producing or trading anything anymore. You know, that's a key moment in what made capitalism possible. The fact that those guys really do organize to protect their interests. The irony, of course, is that these are exactly the same guys who looked at this complete junk that was being, you know, these complicated derivatives, which were really elaborate scams based on the assumption that the governments would bail them out when they went up, belly up. You know, they gave them AAA ratings. Now the very governments that saved them all, they're threatening not to give them AAA ratings anymore if they don't do what they're told. System of extortion, basically.
David Graeber has been our guest. Again, he teaches anthropology at Goldsmiths University of London, and he is the author of the new book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. David Graeber, I appreciate your time.